This is Adam Gregg interviewing Wilbur Hansbarger on July 22nd, 2005, about his World War II experiences. Okay, Wilbur, just to start out, could you state your full name?
Wilbur Lyle Hansbarger, Jr.
Okay, and could you state the date and place of your birth?
6/2/26, and I was born in Cherokee, Iowa.
Okay, and where did you live as you were growing up?
Well, at first I lived until I was 14. I lived 6 miles north of Sutherland, Iowa. And there, from there I moved to Washita and went to school at Grand Meadow. Finished out my schooling at Grand Meadow.
And that's in Iowa?
Yeah.
Okay, and before you entered the war, did you work anywhere then, after going to school at Grand Meadow?
No, I went right direct from school to service, but we worked on a farm. We had a big farm, and so we worked there. Time he was old enough to work until we left the farm.
Okay. So what was your experience in the years before the war as the country fought through the Great Depression?
Well, I was kind of little going through most of the Depression. I'm sure you remember it. You know, we didn't have nothing, but then we didn't think anything of it because nobody else had anything either, you know. And we had enough to eat, and living on a farm, you always had enough to eat. Then we had our own meat, butchered our own meat and stuff. So it didn't really affect me all that much. My dad bought that farm north of Sutherland, and he lost it. He bought that in 1925, yeah, and then he lost it in 1932, I think, or 33. And then the insurance company picked it up, you know, and like they did a lot of them. And so from then on, we rented it until he bought a farm down at Washita. And moved down there. I was just 14 years old when we moved down there.
And what were the circumstances there?
Well, then we farmed a half section, and then we rented another quarter. But we had there's four boys and dad, so we could handle it all right. Till my oldest brother went to service, and I was in 41, and I went to service in 44, and so at the end it was just him and my dad and my youngest brother, Paul, farmed the, so he had to give up some of the land. They couldn't quite do all of it. And we enjoyed going to school. Grand Meadow was all country kids, you know, and small school, and country consolidated. About it, I guess, for that.
Okay. So, as you were in high school, what were your thoughts as war was breaking out in Europe before the U.S. got involved?
Well, we was concerned, you know, because my dad was in World War I, and I thought, you know, sooner or later, us kids would have to go, and if it would have happened that it kept on going, which it did, and of course, my oldest brother and I both, we both enlisted, so my brother next older than me, he was drafted, but he when they registered him 4F, they wouldn't take him because he had a bad leg and some other things wrong. And my youngest brother, he went in after the war and enlisted.
Okay, what were your thoughts when America was attacked at Pearl Harbor, bringing the U.S. into the war?
Well, I thought that would really involve a lot of us, you know, it would affect a lot of families around. And it did, you know. Most of the young guys was in that age area. Harry was going off to the service, and of course I was too young then yet when, back I was only, 14, I guess, about when they attacked Pearl Harbor. It didn't take long until I was old enough to go. But it just seemed like, you know, like when you're a kid, there's something you're reading from the funny books and stuff, and you don't really get so involved with it. But I heard the older people talking a lot about it and stuff, you know, what they thought and stuff. And I didn't really think about me being in it at that time, you know.
Do you and your friends ever talk about it?
Not too much. We was too busy playing basketball and baseball and the girlfriends and all that stuff, you know. No, we didn't talk about the war much.
You said some of the older people would be talking about
it. Yeah, a lot of the older people talk a lot about it, you know. When you're kids, you don't really worry too much about things like that. It'll take care of itself, you know. Of course, when my brother went in and was gone, and we thought about him a lot, you know, and missed having him around.
What was that like when he left for the service?
Well, we really missed him, and he didn't get home for a couple of years, and then the second time he was gone, he left, I think, another 2 years or so before he got out and got discharged. He enlisted in the Navy and was transferred to the Marines as he was a medic. Marines don't have their own medics, so they take the Navy corpsmen and make them their medics. And so he dressed in a Marine uniform and everything until he got out of service, and then he went back to Navy uniform before he got discharged. Then he stayed in the reserve and retired from the Navy Reserve as Lieutenant Commander in the Navy, in the Medical Corps. Me, just a third class petty officer.
So when you did enlist, what branch of service did you join?
I enlisted in the Navy. That's where I thought I wanted to go. And so, then I don't know. I just kind of thought that'd be the nicest sailing around on a ship around the world. But then my brother's in the Navy, so I thought that'd be a good deal. Probably, you know, I could have stayed out and got deferred to the farm, but then that ain't what I wanted to do, and I'm surprised my folks let me enlist, you know, at that age, but they did.
You feel like you made the right decision?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. You grow up pretty fast, but No, it was what I wanted to do, and so they let me do it.
Where were you living at the time you enlisted?
Ouachita, Iowa.
Do you recall your first days in service?
Yeah, pretty much. I went to Des Moines to get signed in, you know, and all the tests they gave you and stuff would drive you bananas and almost. And then they put us on a train, and we went to Farragut, Idaho, and then they went through all the tests and stuff all over again. Then assigned us to companies there. And that's where I took my boot training at.
What was boot camp like for you?
Oh, I didn't like it. Nobody does. They try to, they march you everywhere you go, you know. They march you, they go eat dinner, and in the morning you get you up about 5 o'clock and run obstacle courses and stuff, you know. Of course, physically, I was young enough, they didn't bother me too much. But some of them guys in their 30s, it was tough. Then I got pneumonia while I was there. And in the summertime, and there, and it's cold out in the mountains in the summertime at night, and I got pneumonia, so I was in the hospital a month out there. Then I got back, had to go to a different company. I didn't like that very good, but I would get acquainted pretty fast. I was trying to think, I come up, when I got out of there in September, I think I got to come home for a few days. And then I went back to Farragut, and then they sent me to Shoemaker, California. And then Shoemaker, California was only there about 10 days, and they sent me to Hawaii. And I was there about 2 weeks, and they sent me to, shipped out of there. Went to Iniwetok. And then I was there until December. In December, went from Iniwetok to Lithi in the Carolines. And I stayed there till on March 15th, 1945. And that's when I went to Okinawa. And I stayed there until it was over there, war was over there, and at Okinawa, and then the war was over against Japan, and I went, and after that, then I went to Japan until I got sent back to the States. First I went to Sasebo, and then the harbor in Sasebo, and then I went to Yokohama Harbor there.
Okay, are there any other training experiences you'd like to share? You mentioned you had gotten pneumonia. Maybe we could expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, I was in the hospital. There was 100 in the room. They had 100 beds in the room for different things. And not very fancy place, but they had. When I went to, finally went, I didn't want to go to see a doctor or anything. I knew if I get to the hospital or something, I'd lose my company, you know, and didn't want to do that. But I got up in line to see the doctor. He told the guy ahead of me, he said, if I see you back here again, I'm going to sign you an awful lot of work. And when he got to me, and he sent another one of them goof-offs up here. And so I went up. Doctor, he listened to me. He hollered over the other doctor, "Hey, we got a sick one." And they put me in a place there, and they started giving me sulfa. And they checked me a couple hours later, some doctor did, and they loaded me up and took me to the main hospital. And a lot of doctors, foreign doctors, most of them, a lot of them were. I don't know where they got them, but I guess we were short. From India, a couple of them were. They're good guys, though, good doctors. But I couldn't understand them at all.
So how did you get through boot camp? You said it was pretty difficult.
Oh, yeah, it was interesting, that's for sure. I just couldn't get used to marching to everything you did, you know. And of course, they put you on guard duty, and that's where I got pneumonia, on guard duty around the camp. But boot camp has tried to make you humble, I guess, and it did me. That's a good training, though. We get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. We either run the obstacle course or run 5 miles. And then we march, then we go to colors. And after they have colors, then we go to meal, go to breakfast. And then we drill from then on, or whatever they had for us to do, classes. We had I took double some of them classes, which is all right. It didn't hurt me none. Because they figured it was going to go in the amphibs, I think. They didn't tell many of us guys that, but kind of the training way it went on, it was pretty apt to where we was going to end up. You know? So they teach about fighting fires on the ship, and they put you through that, and they put you in these gas chambers, and you hand you the gas mask and turn the gas on, and if you don't get your mask on very fast, it's pretty uncomfortable. And it was a good experience, huh? Then we had fires where they light these gas fires, then we had to put them out with foam and some kind of use spray sometimes, depends on the fire, kind of fire. Then we had Coeur d'Alene, Lake Coeur d'Alene, no, Lake Pend d'Arrée, it was near Coeur d'Alene there. We was, that's where we did all our boat training, you know, running boats and stuff. Beautiful lake up there in the mountain. Then I went from there to Shoemaker, California. That's right near San Francisco. That's where we left from San Francisco. I think it was 10 days to get to Hawaii. I would like to stay at Hawaii, really. That was pretty nice there.
What was that trip like to Hawaii?
Well, you know, that's the only time I got seasick in my life, and that was only for about an hour, I guess. But everybody else is sick around you, and it's just bound to make you sick. But then I was sick for about an hour and got over it and never got seasick again, you know. But that was a, I went to Hawaii on a Coast Guard ship. ship, and all the food was terrible on it right there. I didn't care for the food on Coast Guard ships. But it was a regular troop transport, and I think it's 6,000 men on it. And then they loaded us up at Hawaii to go to Niuetalk. That was a troop transport, too, and it was held about 6,000 men. It took us 2 weeks to get to Niuetalk. And I think it was about a week and a half, or it was 2 weeks from there to Ulithi in the Carolina. And on the Carolinas, or in the Ulithi, we just hauled, I got assigned right away to LCMs. We just hauled supplies around and men around and hauled ammunition from what to the ships and to then we hauled supplies to the natives there too. The natives was all put on one island and none of the servicemen could be around them. That was no-no. That we taking supplies in, we could go in there where they was at. And they had a Dutch guy from Holland in charge of them, an older guy. You know, he's looking after them. He'd been on the islands for, he told us 10 or 15 years he'd been over there, and missionary to these people. But the kids, I don't think they wore any clothes until they were 16. And then they just wore little G-strings and stuff. The girls and boys same, they just run around there nude all the time. And watch them when they used to eat a lot of these roots they dug up and take these little kids 2 or 3 years old, they'd be out there working. The men didn't do nothing. The men just sat around, didn't do a thing. They'd do a little fishing once in a while, but all the hard work was done by the women and the kids. When we went to the islands, we got, you get your orientation booklet, and I thought that told you couldn't be native, and none of them really were, because they put them all on a different island, but told us at Mogmog, when we was at Mogmog, we had to be careful of them big lizards, because they were a religious symbol to them people, and we couldn't harm them in any way or bother them in any way. So they were harmless, they wouldn't harm you. Scare you though, they were so big, you know, 7 feet long, you know, and they stood about 2 feet high. Just gonna walk around, they just ignored you because that was their place and you was in the way, so you have to get out of their way. But they had something to do with their religion, they worshiped them or something. But there wouldn't be any reason to harm them anyway. Yet some of these people I raised on the East Coast and stuff, though. They wouldn't use good judgment. They'd probably kill them or something, you know. But then maybe not either. But
you mentioned you served at Okinawa. Do you remember arriving there, and what was it like?
Oh, yeah, I remember very much. Well, the way it started out, we all went to bed. My unit was going to the, moving to the Philippines, and 8 o'clock that night, they come around with their board and stuff, and took down names and are you on LCM so-and-so? And yeah, and there's three of us signed to that. And it was, I think it was 21 or 25 men. And we had to be at gangway the next morning and at 8 o'clock. And we couldn't take any of our anything with us except our ditty bag and our blues, one set of blues, and that's all we could take with us. And then, we had no idea where we was going at all. They tell us on the, after he's out to sea for 24 hours or so. But, you know, I had all my friends I went overseas with and everything, and I hated to leave. And these other guys that barely knew that I went up there with. So. But anyhow, we got out to sea. They said, well, you're going to Okinawa. I never heard of it before, you know. Most of us hadn't, you know, heard of it before even. So we didn't know what to expect. But when we got there, we tried to get in the harbor at Karamarato in the Suicide. We had an escort. They took us in a dry dock, you know, it's a floating dock, dry dock, because they had so many destroyers up there hit. They needed a dry dock to put them in for repairs and stuff to fix them, and instead of taking them clear back to Hawaii. So we come in with the dry dock and the escorts. Let's see, we had three destroyers and two gunboats, I think it was. And anyhow, these suicides started coming in, and these guys started shooting on them, and I don't know, they dropped a net somehow. We got through the net into the harbor, and they hit several of the ships around there. And the escort that's closest to us, it hit it right in the gun pit and then bounced off, and it killed all six guys in the gun pit there. We could watch all that happen, and then it hit some of the other destroyers out there. And I don't know how many got killed on them, but we got in there and we didn't get a scratch on us, and I think that's what they was trying to get, was the dock, you know, but they didn't get it. Well, this, what was her name, Tokyo Rose, they kept telling on that station that there was a dry, the floating dock heading for Okinawa, and she didn't call it that, though. She used to call Okinawa Gunno. And she says, it's a shame that's never going to get there. So we're kind of wondering about that. Make you think, you know. We got there all right. Then we took our LCMs out and stuff. And we was assigned to different ships. I was assigned to ARB. That's the auxiliary repair battle, you know, battle damage repair, and we just assigned up to it. We worked all over the harbor. And then we moved over to, from Karamarato, we went over to Aishima, and then on over to Buckner Bay on Okinawa, on the other side of the island, and we laid, Karamarato, we laid smoke screens there every night, just about, that it wasn't cloudy, and daytime we'd haul supplies. We'd never get enough sleep. We'd be so wore out that, you know, you go to sleep standing up. But they were short of men, you know, you had to have somebody mechanically, enough to know how to run them generators and also run the LCM. But got the job done. Well, we could just cover them generators. We you could cover this whole town, I think, with one generator, just about. And then run low on them, they started using the 5-pound, or 5-gallon ones, and them almost killed you. You get back in after laying on them and get done with them, and you just couldn't hardly breathe, you know. They're so acrid, you know. And I thought of it, it's going to kill all of us, just breathing that stuff. But it didn't. We all lived through it. But we had, when we first went back there, we had a cook there, because we didn't really have any schedule or anything. Then we come in maybe 11, 12, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, you never know. And he'd always have stuff baked for us. He told us what door it was in the galley, in the kitchen there. And he had coffee, so we, because you couldn't go to sleep for quite a while. You got to sit down and just kind of relax a bit. So we'd go in there at night and we'd get some coffee and find a drawer, and there'd be some rolls in there or something for us. And he got hit right after that. The shell on the deck, and hit the deck on the there. I was just walked away from him going downstairs. We had to go down. The medical ship hit, and we was had to go out there and pick up survivors. And I just got about 10 steps down the gangway, and the shell hit the deck there. And he tore him up all through the stomach and stuff, and then he got back. He was loaded on a stretcher, and they had a boat there. Him and another guy got hit in the leg, taking them to a hospital ship someplace. And he said, "I'm going home, Hans." And I said, "Well, I'm glad for you, but I just hope you get okay." He said, "Oh, I will." I don't know. He was hurt pretty bad, so I never could find out if he was made it or not. The other guy was pretty much hitting the legs, and he was doing the most hollering and stuff. And maybe it hurt the worst. I don't know, you know. But they took them out of there. But if I had, just 2 seconds would have made a difference, you know. I would have been there, too. But I was lucky. I was always at the right place, so I wouldn't get hit.
How'd you feel after a close call like that?
Don't think too much of it, really. I really think probably the closest I come to really getting killed was by my own men. The Lance smoke screens and this here destroyer that had been kamikaze and stuff, about 4 or 5 kamikazes in it. They had their guard set up and stuff on there, and I had that, took a VP out and was laying smoke screens, and terrible job for one guy, but they were short of men. The other two guys took the LCM, our boat. And anyhow, when I got back, you know, and just everything was covered with fog, and you couldn't see nothing, you know. But I found we had amber lights we'd signal, you know, give signals so they know who it was coming in. So I got the VP in there, and then I tied it up and stuff. And coming up over on the deck, and here's the guy holding the 45 at my head. He's just shaking, and I said, "Hey," I said, "don't you know me?" And he finally put the gun down, and he's still shaking, and said, "I almost killed you." And they were so nervous, you know, and upset that he really wasn't thinking. And boy, I tell you, I got to think the next day, now that, what would I have done different, you know? Could have been singing or something, but that wouldn't have made any difference. The Japanese used to sing too, you know? And put you off guard. But I figured maybe that was probably the closest I'd come, but who knows, you know? You never know. But he went this guy come and see me the next day too, and he was still scared.
Was this someone you knew?
Huh?
Was this someone you knew?
No, he was on this destroyer that got hit, you know. And that's where I tied up behind that destroyer that
okay.
got bombed, you know.
Okay.
And suicided. I was just lucky, I guess. And we laid those smoke screens there, and then we went over to then Buckner Bay, and then on the east side of Okinawa, and then we laid smoke screens there for quite a while. Well, until the war was over. We used to kind of pray for a cloudy day, cloudy night, and you wouldn't have to lay smoke screens. You know. Go out sundown, and then you'd have to be out there at sun up, you know, because that's when they'd come in, either sundown or sun up. Then we have the compass, and we try to figure out, you know, if you didn't know where you're at, a compass, you don't know which direction to go anyhow. And it gets bad, so we couldn't get in some nights, and one night we got way off where we were supposed to be, you know, and they pulled up along this here kind of little ship. We thought it was an American ship, and then we seen the Japanese riding on it. And figured, gosh, it's got to be a storage ship or something. So we just kind of quietly tied up to it, and just kind of stayed there all night until the next morning, and we put that thing. As soon as we could figure out where we had to go, we just run full throttle, battle speed, you know, and got the heck out of there, because we knew there's Japanese on the islands right near it, you know. And when we got enough daylight, we could tell it was a wooden storage ship, you know. So chances are there wasn't nobody on it, thank goodness.
Could you clarify for me a little bit, what was your official job or assignment?
Boat crew, landing craft. Yeah, I was an amphibious, the landing craft. And on an LCM, there's 3 men to a crew. That was coxswain and bowman, and the other guy was a coxswain and a bowman, and then the third guy was he's fireman rate. He'd take care of the engine, changing the oil and stuff like that, and then he helped the bowman too with tying that up and stuff. See, an LCM is it's got. I don't know the exact size of it now. It's got 2 gray marine diesel engines in it. And the bow, it comes, you know, drops down so you can run vehicles or men out of it. And we took men to the shore, took small tanks to the shore. One of them 6x we take to the shore, personnel carriers and stuff. And they got all pretty good. Pretty good load in there. Then we haul a lot of stuff to other ships, to the cargo nets and lift it out of it. Yeah, a lot of bombs and shells of all sizes and things. Well, some of the battleships and big shells, it'd take many to have a big load. Of course, a lot of other ships use 5 inches about all they go, and then a lot of 40 millimeter and stuff like that. But when I got to Japan, though, I got a different job. I got to run a PB, and that was a personnel carrier, and it belonged to one officer. And so I just take this one officer where he wanted to go around the harbor, and Yeah, that was nice. And of course, it's got a separate apartment. I sat out in the open, got wet, and the officer, they had a cover over it, the back, you know, and nice white seats in there and stuff, and didn't pick up a nurse once in a while. And of course, I couldn't see anything back there, so I don't think anything went on, but maybe did, maybe didn't, I don't know. But he told me where to go, and we're down in the harbor and something. It was nice to run. That was a 20-footer, and it had a Chrysler engine in it. You could really go, you know, really get out and move. But it's wood, and it just have a lot of problems with seams breaking on it. But then after that I got done, then I was signed to a ship, and then eventually we had to come back to the United States on that ship. Can't think of the name of it even now. Much different, I guess.
In your capacity as a crew member on an LCM, did you ever come under small arms fire then?
Oh, yeah. We strafed. And we strafed on the beach, though. That'd be Gray Beach. I think it would be at Okinawa, but anyhow, got on the beach and starting to get a leak on the front end of the boat, and so we took it into the beach and we had to stay there all night. And looked like a Betty, a Japanese Betty, but it come along strafed, but there was a pile of coral that these CBs had put up, you know. And thank God for that, because they couldn't get down. The nose down far enough, and get up and go over that coral. And saved our lives, I'm sure of that. But that was the kind of luck I had, I think. Everything worked out. But we was had small arms fire, too, that night and stuff. Trying to think, it was in near Kermarotto there. They were shooting at us off an island, and this Marines, we took a unit of the Marines in there, and they give them, I had a carbine. We went up to this cave, and had a Japanese prisoner, and he was, he went in the cave and told them to come on out, or, you know, they would kill him in there. And they gave him so much time, and he come back out, and he was there and waiting for him, and nobody come out, and he went and talked to the interpreter, and he told him that they're not coming out. And so this Marine major, he just given the order to fire underneath, use flamethrowers and fire in that cave. That was the end of them, and I can't figure out why, you know. They wouldn't come out, you know, surrender. But we weren't shot at anymore from that island anymore, anyway. That's where they was hiding, in that cave, and they come out at night where nobody could see them.
What were those flamethrowers like?
Oh, it's a terrible thing, really. They just throw a ball of fire. You take a bush or something, that it hit that bush, it just disintegrated. And then they fire these into them caves and stuff, and all you hear a few screams, and that'd be all of it. And you could smell flesh burning and stuff, you know. And that's something you never forget, you know, things like that. I'm glad I didn't have to use one.
Did you ever come under artillery fire then?
Well, yeah, we had all kinds of shelling and stuff, you know, in different places. But I don't know. I think the thing I remember most about, you know, when these planes come in with bombs and stuff, and Japanese planes, and the noise it would make when everybody was shooting at all these ships was firing at the same time, some 60, 70 ships probably. And you couldn't talk to anybody, you had to forget about it. You know, you had to write it down, or you could stand right next to your ear and yell, and you couldn't hear nothing. But I don't know, I think I remember the kamikaze mostly, because everyone seemed like it's coming to hit right at you, you know, and it could be coming 200 yards away and hitting the ship, but always seemed like it was gonna coming at you and went into this dive.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, those kamikaze attacks. What'd you do to survive in something like that?
Well, you just hope they weren't going to hit you, you know. And, they opened fire on them, you know. A lot of times they could shut it, cut them down, you know, and hit the water and land in the water instead of on a ship. But they called it Karamaretto there, Bogey Gulch. That's where all the suicides come in there, about 100, I don't know how many ships.